This is Radio Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. New research may give insight into a better way to lift people out of poverty. Scientists have found that the stress of living in poverty can actually change the brain.
And that has a Boston nonprofit wondering if it can change the brain in positive ways to help people succeed. To learn more about how this research is translating into anti-poverty programs, we're joined by Elizabeth Babcock. She's president and CEO of the nonprofit Crittenden Women's Union. Beth, thanks for coming to the studio.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
And could you lay out for us what it is about brain science research that says that the stress of living in poverty can change the brain?
Well, there's mounting evidence that being exposed to stress over long periods of time changes the way our executive functioning works, which is, to get into the science, prefrontal cortex development. It is the area of the brain that governs what we have as our capacities to navigate the world, make choices, and make those choices well. Poverty itself can basically affect the way that that wiring is built out.
So if the idea is that the stressors of poverty actually change the brain in a way that makes it harder to make the decisions and do the things you need to do to get out of poverty, tell us what it is that Crittenden Women's Union is doing to try to address that problem.
There are just a number of wonderful things that brain science begins to point out about ways that we can work more effectively with people in thousands of ways. Like, for example, women who are having problems organizing and setting priorities, if you do things like help them organize their personal homes or organize their time, set up schedules or reminders or prompts to do things, when you start that, then what happens is that external help with organizing decreases the stresses that they have going on in their lives and frees up literally, physically frees up brain space to then deal with the problems that crop up in the day and make decisions in a more effective way.
Beth Babcock, I want to bring into this conversation one of the women that your organization, Crittenden Women's Union, has helped, and this is Loretta Brennan. She grew up in South Boston, and she's been working with your organization for about 5 years, I believe, and Loretta is joining us by phone. Hi, Loretta. Thanks for making time for us.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Could you tell us a little bit about yourself and what your life was like before and after you worked with Crittenden Women's Union?
Before, I lived off of welfare, $429 a month, hardly enough money. I didn't have adequate daycare for my son. I was depressed, in a bad relationship. I was basically in survival mode. Now, I work full-time. I graduated Bunker Hill Community College. My health is better. I walk through my fears today. I'm not scared, depressed, and feeling inferior. I consider myself a strong, professional, single mother.
And Loretta, what kind of help did you get from Crittenden that you think helps you become all the things you are today?
When we first sat down with my mentor, the first thing we looked at was the bridge to self-sufficiency. It's a bridge that focuses on a few core areas in how we move to that self-sufficient level. So when I first started, it was very difficult to focus on these things because I didn't have enough money and I didn't have anyone to mind my son. So my mentor was able to work with me to put some basic things into place that I couldn't do alone.
Elizabeth, I want to come back to you as we've heard Loretta talk about what she went through. You know, she talks about sort of being in a more stable environment, being in a community of support. That sounds to me like social services and behavioral therapy more than it does brain science.
What's important to realize is that people, in order to be able to move out of poverty and get into more stable places in their lives, they need to have two things, basically. They need to have the internal wherewithal to make wise decisions when they're multitasking and juggling on a daily basis about how to use their time and their resources. But they also need to have the ability to then connect to resources and utilize those resources in wise ways. Over time, the coaching improves the decision-making, the frameworks decrease these stresses and introduce organizational frames into people's lives, and that this together creates the mental space and the mental wherewithal to then be able to utilize the resources that are available in a better way, in a more powerful way.
Our Common Health blog here at WBUR had done a post recently about this research. One of the senior VPs at your organization, Chuck Carter, was quoted in this, and he had said, one of the things the brain science brings is something of an aha in terms of why things are sometimes harder than we expect them to be.
what I took away from that was that when we see poverty being so enduring generation to generation,
right.
it may not just be because of financial limitations, but because the, again, stressors of poverty have made it hard in the brains of people who are impoverished to develop the skills you need to really thrive in certain jobs.
Well, it's not only to develop them, but it's also to deploy them. I mean, any one of us in a given set of circumstances. My father died last year. And when he died and I had to go to the hospital to be with my mother, I couldn't find my keys. I couldn't find my cell phone. I couldn't basically do the basic tasks that are so easy for me to do because I was under stress. And all of us have experienced that in our lives. With our families, they're under those stresses constantly, day in and day out. And what it means is that the kind of normal decision making that we take for granted just becomes that much more compromised. But the problem is with the families that we serve, every decision counts more. Where and how they spend every penny or every minute of a day is more precious because there are fewer minutes and there are fewer pennies. And so because of that, you have this fierce catch-22 that happens where the skills that are most needed are most compromised. It's a vicious, vicious cycle. And what we've found is that this new lens allows us to shove a wedge into that vicious cycle. It allows us to create increased bandwidth, to create strategies that decrease stress in the moment, that increase our ability to penetrate through and serve people more effectively in our approaches in the moment under that stress. And ultimately what changes is what you heard Loretta say so profoundly, that she feels she's more in control and more in charge of her life.
That's Elizabeth Babcock. She's president and CEO of the nonprofit Crittenden Women's Union. Beth, thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me.
We've also been hearing from a Loretta Brennan, who has been helped by the Crittenden program. Loretta, thanks to you, too.
Thank you for having me.
And let's stick with the subject of brain science, and let's talk a little bit about the huge advances in the field. Tomorrow, WBUR will launch a multi-part series called Brain Matters, reporting from the front lines of neuroscience. And joining us with a bit of a preview is WBUR's health and science reporter and co-host of our Common Health blog, Carrie Goldberg. Hi, Carrie.
Hey, Anthony.
Always good to see you.
You too.
So tell us what inspired this series, what it's about.
Well, the series explores what some people are saying may be a coming golden age for neuroscience, for brain science. You might have heard that President Obama chose brain science as sort of his signature science initiative, the same way that JFK did the moonshot. And what's going on is two big factors. One is that there's been this rising awareness that brain disorders, so everything from autism to dementia to Alzheimer's disease, is just a worldwide scourge that basically outweighs everything else in terms of the disease burden that it imposes. Mm. And then second of all, neuroscience itself has been making these really incredible strides forward. And so the two things converge into a sense that this field is happening.
Mm, really sounds interesting. So you mentioned those incredible strides. Give us an example or two of those incredible strides forward.
Well, it's actually strides in making tools, kind of the same way that we needed the telescope to understand space or the microscope to understand germs. So scientists have been making great strides on making tools, everything from using DNA to figure out which genes increase the risk of mental illness in a person, to super cool sort of technologies like this thing called optogenetics, where you can turn neurons in the brain on or off using laser light. Mm. And so you can affect what the brain is doing and figure out which neurons do what.
Really, really interesting. Now, a lot of this, Carrie, of course, happening right here in Boston, right?
Yes, Boston is really a major hub. You may not have known we were a hub for this, but actually we are a major hub for neuroscience. We've got MIT, we've got Harvard, we've got Boston University, we have lots of other universities, and there are a lot of mind-boggling things coming out of these labs all around here.
And yes. We're going to be talking about some of those right here tomorrow on Radio Boston.
Right.
Just give us a hint of at least one of the players that's going to be involved.
Well, so tomorrow we will have here on Radio Boston as a guest Robert Desimone, who's the director of MIT's McGovern Institute for Brain Research, which is in the building at MIT, which may have more neuroscience in it than any other in the world, actually. That's possible. And he'll be talking in part about the effort to try to figure out how a gene can, in fact, affect the brain and lead to a mental illness, which is this very important bridge that scientists are trying to build.
Well, that'll be really interesting to hear. Carrie, one final question, just what it's been like for you working on this series. And I'm wondering if it's changed at all the way you think about your own brain.
You know, it has. It has sort of twisted my mind around in the sense that we like to tell these very simple stories about our minds. Like when in the mid 20th century, it was Freudian, right? It was that if you have problems, it was your mother.
Right.
And then later on, it's been brain biology. It's been like, if you are depressed, it's because you're low on your serotonin. And now we're heading into a whole new era of sort of computational neuroscience. It's about your math. It's about your algorithms. And that's a lot harder to tell stories about, frankly.
All right. That's Carrie Goldberg, health and science reporter for WBUR. She's co-host of the Common Health blog. She was talking about WBUR's multi-part series, Brain Matters, Reporting from the Front Lines of Neuroscience, which will launch tomorrow on Morning Edition and right here on Radio Boston. Carrie, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And time now to talk about the week in sports. And there's a lot happening these days, beginning with the Red Sox, who are struggling to recapture a bit of last year's championship magic.
Also, the World Cup begins tomorrow in Sao Paulo, Brazil. And the hope for a Triple Crown winner came
and went. Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game, joins us now. Hey, Bill.
Hello, Anthony.
So I'm afraid we're going to have to start with the Red Sox. And you and I were...
Why am I not surprised?
You and I actually were having an interesting conversation just recently about this team, and I have to ask you, what are we to make of them? They lose 10 in a row, they win 7 in a row, then they lose 5 in a row. So to me, it's interesting because they're substantially the same team they were a year ago, and yet they sure aren't playing like they were a year ago.
Well, I guess the short answer to this question is the same answer I got years ago when NPR sent me to talk to the Orioles the year after they had won the World Series. They finished last in their division. And I talked to several players, and they all gave me the same answer. They said, last year, everything that could go right went right. This year, everything that can go wrong is going wrong.
Mm.
And I suppose that means from injuries to players thinking they've been put in the wrong position to guys suddenly going into prolonged batting slumps all at the same time. And it taking 10 games for somebody to wake up and drive in some runs. All the kind of vagaries that make baseball what it is.
Well, one of the themes we always talk about with you is how you're a fan of the story as opposed to the outcome in sports. And I agree with you, but I'm confused about the Red Sox in this way. I'm not sure what the story is. Is it first to worst? Is it, no, they're late bloomers?
Well,
no,
I
they're going to be contenders again? I'm sort of at a loss.
I'm beginning to doubt that they'll be contenders.
Yeah.
This year. But I'm going to adopt the Charlie Pierce theory of the 2014 Red Sox, which is they were such fun last year. Let's give them a pass.
Okay. All right. We'll give them a pass. And that's it for the Red Sox. Sasha.
And Bill, I want to ask you about the big story in horse racing this week, which is that, of course, a lot of racing fans had hoping that California Chrome was going to be the first horse in 3 decades to win the Triple Crown of the Belmont Stakes on Saturday. But he finished fourth.
Tied for fourth.
What was tied?
It was tied.
Was
it was
he
a
tied
dead heat
fourth?
For fourth, as I understand it.
And I think
it.
2 lengths behind the champion Tonalist. So the co-owner of California Chrome, Steve Coburn, was criticized for being a bad sport about the loss because he called the other horses and their owners a bunch of cheaters. And he argued that the horses who don't have enough points to run in the Kentucky Derby should not be allowed to run for the Triple Crown at Belmont the same year. Here he is talking to ESPN last weekend.
These people, they nominate their horses for the Triple Crown, which means three. And then they hold out 2 and then come back and run 1. That'd be like me at 6'2 playing basketball with a kid in a wheelchair.
Now, Coburn has since apologized for these comments. But I wonder, Bill, if you think he has a fair point. Because he did say that it's true. Some of the horses running hadn't raced as frequently as his horses did in the weeks leading up to the Belmont. So other horses were fresher and less tired.
Yeah, there are a whole bunch of theories about how to train racehorses. One is run your horse a lot so he'll always be in shape. Another is rest your horse a lot so he'll always be in shape. You pick your theory. No, he doesn't have a point, and his analogy is stupid and insulting. People make all sorts of decisions about what to do with their horses. It's true at the track every day, and it's just as true of big money races like the Triple Crown races.
Now, horse racing is a sport struggling a bit to maintain its fan base, maybe an older fan base. Do you think if there had been a Triple Crown win, that would have been a good boost for the sport's popularity?
History suggests that there is a very short-term boost. I don't think it's the long-term boost. I think Massachusetts, in that respect, is probably representative. The track here in Boston, Suffolk Downs, has been saying for some time that they can't make it without offering opportunities to gamble beyond betting on horses. And I think that's the case across the country. Lots of tracks have closed.
Bill, let's move on to World Cup soccer.
Good idea.
Good idea. From the Red Sox to horse racing to now something Bill is really happy about. The World Cup kicks off tomorrow when Brazil faces Croatia. There aren't huge expectations for Team USA right now, but the team did win all three of its preliminary matches, including a match against Nigeria, considered to be a pretty strong team. So here's the U.S. men's national soccer team coach, Jurgen Klinsmann, expressing an uncharacteristic amount of confidence to ESPN yesterday.
I don't think so that they are better than us. I think that we are eye to eye with them. I don't think that we are an underdog by absolutely no means. I think we are there to challenge them and go into the next round.
So get to the next round. Bill, what's your view on how the U.S. Will compete in this tournament?
I think they'll compete well. I don't necessarily think they'll get to the next round, but they've got a tough go. Portugal is very good. Germany is always strong and always seems to be ready at the World Cup level, although European teams traditionally don't do especially well in tournaments in this hemisphere. And then Ghana is hardly a gift. The first team that the U.S. plays, Ghana's beaten them twice in the last two, or stopped them twice in the last two World Cups. So it certainly won't be easy, but there's some players. The game has grown in this country. We have a league of our own that showed some stability, and we got lots of U.S. players who've had some success, at least in Europe. I'm thinking Clint Dempsey in the U.K., and lots of goalkeepers who've gone over there and done just fine. So I don't think they're going to be a patsy for anybody.
You saw a bunch of the preliminary matches this week, a bunch of the other ones. Who should we be keeping an eye on? Who are you excited to see?
Well, you have to worry a little bit about Ghana, which may be peaking at the right time. They beat South Korea convincingly in their last preliminary match. Otherwise, it's anybody's guess, and that's why the World Cup is such fun.
All right. Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. You can hear it right here on WBUR Saturday mornings at 7 a.m. and again at 7 p.m. Bill, thanks so much.
Thank you, Anthony.
Stay with us. Coming up, we'll be talking about the resurgence of craft beer here in New England. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.